This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
You're listening to The West Wing Weekly. I'm Rishi K. Sherway.
And I'm Joshua Molina. And we're here to discuss Season 1, Episode 11 of The West Wing, titled Lord John Marbury. The story is by Patrick Cadell and Lawrence O'Donnell. The teleplay is by Aaron Sorkin and Patrick Cadell, and it was directed by Kevin Rodney Sullivan.
Here's the NBC synopsis. The Kashmir border powder keg becomes more explosive when the Indian Army invades Pakistani-held territory, making the threat of a nuclear confrontation frighteningly real to President Bartlett, who calls in Lord Marbury, an eccentric British diplomat with ties to both warring nations and a weakness for booze. An angry Josh is subpoenaed to testify as the investigation into substance abuse among White House staffers grinds on towards its inevitable target, Chief of Staff Leo McGarry. Mandy floats a trial balloon among the staff to test their reaction to her notion of representing a liberal Republican. The president is surprised when Charlie asks him if he can date his willing daughter, Zoe.
I think Angry Josh was the incredibly unpopular app sequel to Angry Birds. No one bought it. Okay, today we're joined, this is exciting, by two very special guests, the actors who played Ed and Larry.
And do you know which is which?
I believe I do. William Duffy, which ends with the E sound, played Larry. Oh. And Peter James Smith, which rhymes with Ed, played Ed.
That's a great mnemonic device. Yeah.
Good morning.
Really good. Good morning, guys.
Thanks for joining us. You know, you are clearly fan favorites. A lot of people through Twitter and through our website reached out and demanded that we have you. Maybe before we dive in, we should unpack the Ed and Larry of it all. Can you guys tell us how you each became part of the show?
I actually originally auditioned for Sam Seaborn, and I was in the room and I saw that Rob was there. He actually, I don't know if he was auditioning, but he had walked out of the room. And I'm like, I'm in trouble. I auditioned well. I mean, the room, to this day, I've never seen that many people in an audition room, you know, including Tommy Shalami, Aaron, John Wells was there. John Levy obviously was reading, Kevin Scott, all the assistants, all the other writers. I mean, it looked like my parole hearing.
That's intimidating.
It was.
And did Aaron read with you?
No, Aaron did not read with me. He greeted me immediately as I walked in the door because you and I had worked together with Aaron on A Few Good Men.
We were in the national tour of A Few Good Men together.
25 years ago.
Is that right?
Well, we started 25.
1991?
1991, we started rehearsals. We started then the tour in 92. So
how much fun was the tour?
It was ridiculous. It's still one of the highlights of my career.
Me too. We played, let's name some cities. We played Baltimore, San Francisco,
Memphis, Chicago, St. Paul.
Yes, somewhere in Michigan, Grand Rapids.
When we were doing the show, though, that was when Aaron was doing the movie. And so we would actually be testing scenes from the movie in the play because he changed a few things on us.
I don't remember that.
It was a great cast, though. I mean, if you think about the people
tour?
In that tour.
Fantastic. Michael O'Keefe.
Ken Marino.
Boo.
Josh Molina.
He's good. What happened
to
him?
He's very good. Is he still alive?
I think you tweeted a picture of the cast.
I did at one point because
it was amazing.
Yeah.
I had no idea that all of you guys were in
Noah
it.
Emmerich.
Yeah, Noah Emmerich.
Noah Emmerich, yeah.
Dear friend, star of the Americans.
Ron Osher was in it. He was also in the West Wing for a while. I mean, it was just a great, great cast. I mean, Allison Reed, Scott Sowers.
Great memories. Oh, the
carousing. Jordan Lange.
Oh, the drinking. Oh, the acting.
Yeah.
Played
right.
A lot of poker backstage. That
we
was
did.
Also a highlight for me.
Josh took a lot
that
of money.
It was a lot of fun. Yeah, I think I made more playing cards than I did on the tour. You got the job on West Wing.
Yeah, I mean, I obviously didn't get the Sam Seaborn one, but then Aaron called me and said, would you mind coming in for another role? And I said, yeah, because I want to do anything that Aaron does. And that's when I came in to read for the role of Larry. Actually, they had me read for Ed and Larry, because I know I read with two people, and we had to switch each time, which was even harder, and sometimes they're like, read Ed, now read Larry. And so I went in and just read for that and got that part. And the rest is history.
So Duffy knew Aaron already.
Yeah.
How did you get the job, Peter?
A few weeks before the auditions, I had worked on ER. The same casting people did ER that did West Wing. So I'm assuming I was just fresh in their mind. So I had the script, the page for the audition for Ed and Larry. And I was specifically coming in for Ed. And there were three lines. And my little cocky actor self, I was like, that third line, the way I'm going to deliver it is going to get me that job. So I walk in the room, and it's a huge amount of people.
It's huge.
I didn't know Aaron at the time. I didn't know what he looked like. I didn't know who he was. I thought it was a casting assistant reading with me.
Oh, he did read with you.
Yeah, I didn't know. And I only got two of my lines out when Aaron said, thank you.
Wow.
You didn't get to deliver the showstopper.
I didn't. And I was new to town, and I was still kind of like not afraid of anybody. And so I went, I have another line.
And he also said, you didn't realize it was the guy who wrote it?
I didn't. Yeah, and he said, I've seen enough. And I kind of did this, like, attitudinal about face and went, thanks a lot, and left the room.
Really?
Yes, and I got it.
He was like, that guy's got fire.
Yeah, they admired his pluck.
That guy's got pluck,
exactly. That's right.
Admire your pluck.
I'm sorry. What part of me do you admire?
Your pluck. Your gumption.
Thank you.
I've had many auditions for smaller roles, and I've played many smaller roles, and I find it difficult when you've got two lines or three lines. I've done, you know, movies where I had a couple lines, and you just spend, or I do, hours talking through every possible way to say these couple because you want to get the most mileage you can out of something. And I find it actually, it puts me on edge when I have less to do.
I agree with you on that. I mean, I'll do it in drunk. I'll do it in every accent just to see what I can find something.
Yeah.
But it is. I agree with you on that.
Well, one of the reasons I always love when you guys are on the show, and I feel like it pops when you guys are on, is because I believe that you had a life before you walked in front of the camera and that when you exit, your lives continue. You guys have a relationship. You guys just really fill the moments very well.
And some of the fan fiction out there also fills those moments, too.
Absolutely.
I assume you guys are all over each other in the fan fiction. I mean, that's what I always wanted to see, so.
Well, actually, Aaron helped that a bit. There was one interview, I think, where somebody asked him, why are there no gay characters on The West Wing? And he said, how do you know there aren't? Just leaving it there, and that's all he said. And I think people basically assumed
the fandom went nuts.
They went nuts.
Bert and Ernie.
The Twilight series is actually based on erotic fan fiction of Ed and Larry.
That's it.
And everybody was like, are you team Ed? Are you team Larry?
That's it. That's right.
So lead, I guess, would be your ship.
Yeah, that's our name.
Let's lay some lead.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Moving on. Let me ask you this. So when you got the job, would you know how many a season, how many episodes, or would you get a call, are you free next Wednesday? Would it be last minute type of thing?
Oh, yeah, it definitely would be last minute kind of thing. Yeah.
The pilot was like April of 99, and I got a call, I was in Hawaii with my then girlfriend, that it was picked up. They had like a contract. There was a contract as far as when we worked, but there was no guarantee of how many episodes we would work. And so at that point, I'm like, okay, I guess I'm kind of recurring on the show, that'd be great. But it wasn't until actually this episode, when I read this script, that I went, I think we're going to be around for a little bit. Because, you know, the first few episodes, you know, he and I were in the pilot. We had a nice part in the pilot. Then we had little bits in
and not together. Between the pilot and this episode, we were kind of separate.
Yeah, we were in the second episode together. And then he did the short list. And then we came in with this Lord John Marbury episode. That was the point I went, we now are established because we're now working, with everybody. It was the first episode where they list us with both our names.
Ed and Larry,
yeah. Because even though I was called Larry in the pilot, they still had me listed as Staffer Larry, whatever it may be, or sometimes just congressional aide. And they had Ed listed as Ed, but it's not until this episode that they both put Ed and Larry for Peter and myself.
Did your characters have titles?
Not really, but I mean, from what we were doing, and I talked to a few people like when we were in Washington filming, I said, like, you're sort of like a senior staff advisor.
Right.
So we were on the same level administratively as like the main cast. We just weren't on screen as much.
Or paid as much. Yeah.
Peter, you brought the West Wing book, is that what
it's
called?
Yes, it's called The Official Companion, The West Wing.
I feel like we should enter into the record. We have some words of Aaron's about Ed and Larry. Do you mind reading that?
I do not. Let's see. There are the people the president likes to talk to. Ed and Larry are two people these people like to talk to. The reason why you want Ed's and Larry's out there is because you don't want it to seem like the only people working at the White House are the stars of our show. You want to constantly remind the audience it's a much bigger world and our camera is just focused on this right now. I want to mention, you said you were in Hawaii when you heard about the show getting picked up. I had kind of got fed up with L.A., and I had left town. I was living in Washington, D.C. at the time. And so when I got the call that the show was going to come back and I was going to recur, I came back. But before I did, I cold called the White House and said, "Hi, my name is Peter James Smith. I'm going to be on a new show on NBC in the fall called The West Wing. Could I come get a tour?"
That's awesome.
And I did.
Nice.
Yeah, it was.
Did you get any special treatment?
Well, it was an after-hours tour, so they could show me the Oval Office when no one was there. It was great. One guy showed me around. And the next day, I got taken to lunch in the mess by the visitor office head. And one of the funniest things is when they do the Easter egg hunt at the White House, they have these wooden eggs that celebrities have signed, the people find, kids find, I guess. And they had me sign a couple of eggs.
Oh, that's awesome.
And I was like, they're going to be very disappointed when they find this egg. I remember Neil Patrick Harris had an egg there, and the women's Olympic volleyball team had eggs in there.
That's fantastic. That's
really
a great...
cool. But the cachet the West Wing held was just amazing.
Right.
The celebrities and the names and that would just show up on our set were kind of weird. There was one time, and Yo-Yo Ma showed up on the set. And I'm like, wow, it's Yo-Yo Ma. And he's going around and he's shaking people's hands and he comes to us. And I'm like, he knows who we are. He goes, "I love you guys." And he shakes hands. And I shake kind of firm. I was taught to shake a firm handshake.
Oh, no. And so don't crush his bow hand.
This is what happened. He basically puts his hand out and I shake his hand and I hear, "Oh!" And I'm like, oh, my God. And he looked at me. I looked at him and I'm like, uh-oh. And he said, "Nice to meet you." He walked, never shook anybody's hand after that. Nobody got a handshake after that.
Oh, my God. That is hilarious.
It was the bow hand, but I'm like, oh, my God.
You go over and smash his cello after
that? I know. I was like, oh, my God.
I guess you don't need this anymore. Bang, bang, bang.
But it was great to have some people like show up. I mean, that was crazy.
So when did you guys know that you were part of a meteoric hit?
I don't know. It's definitely the first season. I mean, because I'd worked with Aaron before, and I'm just a huge fan of his writing. And even Sports Night that you were on, I was like a huge fan of that.
Even Sports Night?
I mean...
dare you?
I think Sports Night is one of the most underrated shows ever, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
I know, I mean that. I've always been a fan, and I knew the show was going to probably go anyway because Aaron had told me what the cost of the set was from American Precedent that they put on the pilot. I said, oh, they got to amortize this, so it's going to go. But I think, you know, about halfway through the first season, it was like, this is really something special, how much momentum this is actually gaining.
Which is basically where we're at right now. We're basically halfway
through. Look at you. Good segue, Rishi.
You're welcome.
So should we get to the episode?
Sure.
Duffy and Peter, did you guys rewatch it for the podcast?
I did. Yes.
So what do you think of the episode?
I liked it.
I love this episode.
Yeah.
Although I enjoy the fact that the show exists largely in the commonplace goings on of the White House. I also like the ones where things get urgent. And it's been since A Proportional Response that things have been this kind of high-stakes stuff. And I liked that sense of gravity to the entire episode.
I also thought you would like it, Josh, because this one, again, really only has two stories. I mean, there are other sort of sub-stories, but they all tie into one or the other.
That's true. I like going deep into how the White House and the various staff members deal with this impending and unfolding crisis.
It's also a huge episode in terms of cast. Mm. Between the military and the people in the Situation Room and the ambassadors that come through, there's just a ton of faces besides our regular cast members in this episode. John Amos comes back.
Yes, back in the anything that happens in the Situation Room and has John Amos, I'm all for.
Yeah.
Sir, already intense fighting has occurred between Indian troops and Pakistani border garrisons. The ceasefire line's been breached in two thrusts, with five divisions invading the area north of Kargil and a two-corps-sized force that's crossed west into Azad.
It's a very different Bartlett in the Situation Room from A Proportional Response.
Yes.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah, he's really comfortable.
Guy's got his sea legs under him for sure because he's on top of things. And rather than being led around, he's leading this meeting and he's not particularly happy with the support he's getting.
There was one really strange shot with the CIA director in the foreground.
I loved it. It was very cinematic, but it also specifically felt to me, and it gets name checked later, it felt like a shot from Dr. Strangelove. I think I know exactly the shot you're talking about. He's in the foreground. He's really lit, and you're getting a big profile shot as beyond him we're seeing Bartlett.
Yeah, and usually, you know, that kind of shot might happen, but the person in the foreground will be rack focused out and it's on the president or something. But here was like you could see both of them. It felt strangely artificial. And yeah, the composition was completely different.
I had the feeling it was kind of a visual shout out to Strangeland.
That would be great. I hope that's right. Otherwise, it's just weird.
One of the major secondary parallel plots is how CJ, as the press secretary, is treated as news is filtering to the rest of the staff about this Indian incursion into Kashmir. They intentionally leave her out of the loop, the press secretary.
Right.
And she takes it, and I think rightfully so, as a real shot to her credibility with the press corps and a sign of their lack of confidence in her as the press secretary.
Yeah, and I mean, throughout the series already so far, it feels like they've built up the staff as a family. And so for one member of the family to be left out, that's got to be hurtful. The professional credibility, that's an understandable concern for her. But then I think personally, you just have to feel like, oh, so I have some kind of secondary status to everybody else that's in the room.
Mm-hmm. And then later, Toby essentially communicates to her that, one, I guess she's taking a little bit of a hit because of her relationship with Danny.
Right.
Right? And two, he really does question her ability to do her job well because he's not so sure she could omit important information when being grilled by the press.
There is a concern that you're too friendly with the press.
Really?
We know it's important that you have a friendly relationship
with him. It's important for all of us.
I don't disagree.
Does this have to do with Danny Kincannon?
People see you with Danny?
This is outrageous.
It is this one time, and if we aired, it's on the side of trying...
You sent me in there uninformed so that I'd lie to the press.
We sent you in there uninformed because we thought there was a chance you couldn't.
Okay. I have all this work to do.
It's insulting.
Yeah, it keeps coming back to that question that you had of like, how does Danny just get to keep coming back? And in the next episode, they answer it, well, oh, my staff doesn't mind. But then it turns out there are negative ramifications to it, too.
In addition to this whole thing going on, it does seem like she makes a misstep when she is questioned. One of the reporters says, I have a source in the Pentagon, and I've heard about this incursion and 300,000 troops. And rather than pausing or considering that maybe there's something going on that she doesn't know about, she really plays it off.
I've got a source at the Pentagon who says in the last few hours there's been massive troop movement on the Kashmir border.
In the last few hours?
Yeah.
I think you need to get a new source at the Pentagon, Bruce.
So she actually does make a little misstep, right?
Right.
It's
right,
a little bit on her.
Rather than being a more circumspect about it.
Yeah. Let me look into that.
Yeah.
I'd heard at the time that it was based on something that happened to the real press secretary, Dee Dee Myers.
That's right. About a bombing run in Iraq.
Which just shows, I mean, that was in 99, so there really was no internet. I mean, that would almost never happen now.
Well, that's also the internet aspect of it leads into your scene, too.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you guys, and this made me laugh, you guys got me. I think I laughed out loud. I wish there were a shorter way to say that.
Maybe the internet will come up with something.
Oh, see, now that we have it, yes. You guys are giving a briefing.
India's population stands at roughly 1 billion. 82% are Hindus, 11% are Muslim.
They're mostly poor, but not nearly as bad off as Pakistanis.
Yes, whose average per capita income is $400.
They are, however, better educated. Their literacy rate is 48%.
And they're healthier. Average lifespan is 57.7 years.
Yeah, the average rainfall.
The hell kind of briefing is this?
Toby, we could just have another hour to prepare.
Where'd you get this stuff?
I swear to God, the Encyclopedia Britannica.
And I was thinking, like, why are these guys kind of selling it so hard? They're really, like, putting on a show. Like, this doesn't seem just like a normal briefing. And then, of course, I got my answers because you guys don't really know what you're talking about. And you've just pulled some stuff out of the Encyclopedia Britannica. And I had to immediately look up, when was Wikipedia invented? And this is just a year or two out from when Wikipedia would have made your jobs a lot easier. So talk about that scene, if you will.
Well, I mean, this episode meant a lot to me because it was kind of establishing who Ed and Larry were. And I thought this was going to establish who we were. We were going to kind of be the, as Toby, I think, refers to at one point later on, the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. It was a big scene for us. I mean, and we worked hard. I do remember us like going back and forth, making sure we had the dialogue right and the stats right and et cetera, et cetera. This established who we were or who we weren't going to be, so to speak.
Did you guys like each other right away? You guys have good chemistry.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean,
I'm not trying to insinuate anything.
Not at all.
There's no reason why you shouldn't. You're both lovely people.
We really are.
But you guys you hit it off right away. And
would you guys hang out and work on your backstory?
No. Not as much.
The fan fiction did that for us.
Yeah, the fan fiction did that. Yeah. I had my own backstory with what I was and this and that. And I'm sure Peter did the same thing.
No, really.
Peter did not do the same thing. All right.
I don't do backstory either.
I do. It's one of my things just to give me like that moment before of coming in or where I'm going.
Give us a little Larry backstory.
Well, I took some stuff from my own life. Basically, I moved around a lot, which I did in real life. I was a lawyer who wanted to be a little bit more. And so I was always trying to be a little bit more, but just didn't have. When you're an actor, you can't play dumb, so to speak. You play trying to be smart. So that's kind of what I was trying to do with Larry, is try and be smart, but just not doing it well. And so, that's kind of where it was. That was my backstory. I was always just trying to be better and better and better and move up. I mean, I auditioned for Sam Seaborn. I didn't get Sam Seaborn, but I was always thinking, how do I get to be Sam Seaborn as Larry?
That's interesting. That's so good. Yeah. That's funny. Well, now I think one of the reasons why I'm an inveterate avoider of creating a backstory is because I came up in the Aaron Sorkin school. And Aaron would tell you, and this is not as criticism of you. Every actor has their own process and technique. But I remember, maybe you were there, the opening night party for the tour of A Few Good Men. Uh-huh. We opened in Hartford, and we were all sitting around having a beer and a laugh, and I think the performance went well, and everybody was feeling good. And Scott Sowers, who played Colonel Jessup, said, dude, guys, you want to hear Colonel Jessup's favorite joke? And he started, and Aaron said, whoa, hang on. If Colonel Jessup had a favorite joke, it would be written into the play.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it actually was a weird moment. And this didn't surprise me because I know Aaron's take. And it's very sort of there's a mammoth book. It's called True and False, Heresy and Common Sense for the Actor. It's a book that I really like. And I think at one point Mamet says, you know, creating a backstory is a little bit like flapping your arms when you're on a plane to help keep the plane aloft. So Mamet and Sorkin come from the same school where the character is the person who says these things that are on the paper, that are in the script. And that's who the character is. And if there's anything more you need to know, it'll be in the script. It's hardcore and it's a valid point of view. But of course, also most actors bridle under that kind of stricture. And they say, well, there's something I'm bringing to it. And it's their thought processes in my head and their thoughts that I have in there is backstory that I've built up. But it's actually an interesting sort of clash of acting schools of thought.
Yeah.
It's like with the Constitution. Are you an originalist or are you going to interpret the document? You're
nice parallel. That is true. And I think, and having talked to Richard Schiff, he's more of a Duffy actor.
Exactly,
for sure.
Yeah.
And Peter and I are, I guess, on the other side of things. To me, my process is figuring out who the guy is based on all the things that he says and does that are in the script. So to me, it's all very textual. I also think it might be partially because I'm Jewish. I'm a man of the book. I have great respect for the text. I don't create a backstory for the Torah. I look at it.
Aren't there Talmudic scholars who spend their whole life trying to interpret the Torah?
That's all they do.
Yeah.
But they're not writing a lot of backstory. Yeah. Okay. Here's really what happened to King David the early years. It's more.
But what was King David's favorite joke?
If he had one, it would have been in the Torah.
That's right. But
I think I'm more Talmudic. They call it pilpul, I think, is the term for this endless turning over and interpretation of the text. But to me, it all goes back to the text. It all goes back to what this guy is saying. So I'm not inclined to decide this is what this guy did in high school and here's where he went to college if it isn't in the text itself.
Oh, I didn't go that far back.
Back to the plot?
Sure. is this a good time to do Gale's Goldfish Bowl?
Oh, yeah.
I looked at it because of what you guys talked about on the podcast. Was there anything symbolic in this?
Yes. Week? I mean, I paused and looked. First of all, there is a website that has canonized every time there is something special. So I use that as guidance, and then I freeze framed. And there's army stuff in there. It's definitely Marshall. I think it's like
really?
Army vehicles with camo, maybe Jeeps.
And it was Blanche and Steve who did the props, right?
Yeah.
And they were in charge of
Steve
nice.
Props.
Good for you for giving the for the shout out.
Yeah.
Props to the props.
Okay, what else have we got?
One thing early on, Toby says a line to Sam that I did not understand. He's talking to him about the fact they are missing an ambassador in Pakistan. And he says,
what are you hawking me for?
What are you hawking me for? This is a Yiddishism. Hawking is like giving somebody grief and just nattering at them about something. What are you hawking me for?
All right.
Yeah.
See?
Oh, that's so cute, Rishi.
I didn't notice.
I learned something today on the podcast.
Because I was like, like a hawk, like somebody who's like pro-war. It didn't make sense to me. Hilarious.
Well, see, if you had the closed captions on, you would see that it was spelled H-O-C-K-I-N-G.
I went back and turned on the closed captions.
And you were even more confused.
And I was more confused
like, that's
because
not even a word.
There are other things later on in the episode where the closed caption doesn't quite match up with what is being said. And so I was like, is this somebody taking some liberties or they don't understand what's being said either? All right.
That's very funny.
But so it's accurately transcribed in the closed captioning.
Indeed it was.
We get the return of President Bartlett's hybrid take of Pakistan.
Oh, I was trying to listen for it.
Yeah, everybody else says Pakistan, except for the ambassadors from Pakistan and India and Lord Marbury himself. But all the Americans say Pakistan. President says Pakistan again.
Pakistan.
What did we say? Did we say Pakistan or?
You said Pakistan.
We said Pakistan.
Yeah. We have really the A story and the B story, right, is this incursion into Kashmir.
A story.
And then you have Josh being subpoenaed. CJ's story is the other major thing, but it's related to the incursion, I think. So here's my take on this, is that both plots are actually about the same thing, which is about two groups that probably share more in common than, you know, they have more in common than
There's more that unites them than separates them?
Yes, exactly. And in one case, it's religion, and in the other, it's partisanship. But they're both sort of veering towards mutually assured self-destruction because they're playing this game of chicken. And there are things in the dialogue about India that if you were just to replace some of the language, it could be about the other plot. So at the end, there's a DOD advisor who says,
"At various times, both countries have displayed an incoherent decision-making system. You cannot predict what will happen in a crisis."
If you just switch countries for parties, it still works. There's this moment of violence. For the first time on screen, we have violence, which is Josh, like, grabbing Claypool.
"I would think that you would be concerned with your own reputations and the notion of you standing up for a man so egregiously unqualified."
Listen. Josh!
My takeaway was, wouldn't want Josh defending me in a fight.
Yeah,
that was as he gets his hands slapped away immediately.
Yeah, God bless you, Brad Whitford. I was like, the other guy would have pounded him into the floor if it really erupted into fisticuffs.
But a red line was crossed. You know, so there's these like red lines are being crossed on both sides. We were talking about Mandy's line in Enemies where she says to Josh, "You're fighting the wrong fights for the wrong reason." And that kind of gets called back here because she's trying to get Sam to back her up on taking on Mike Brace, who's a Republican, as a client.
"Sam, he's moderate to liberal. He's good on education. He's good on women's rights.
And he's a Republican.
He came to me."
"That's understandable."
"He sought me out."
"You're very good. We'd come to you too."
"Yes."
"In fact, we did."
"Yes. And I'm coming to you now."
"To get me to help you convince Josh and Toby to let you work for a Republican."
"Yes.
This is just my lucky day."
"Sam, I think you are the one senior guy here who is more interested in getting things done than beating
That's
the other."
"That's not true, Mandy. Josh and Toby are just as committed."
"Not lately."
"I disagree."
"The banking bill, the land use rider, assault weapons. You like Mike Brace."
"Mandy."
"I know."
"This is going to be an impossible sell."
"It shouldn't be."
And again, it's this thing that separates her from the team. And I think people are going to be like, oh, Mandy, you know, they're so annoyed. But in both cases, I think she's actually on the side of good or, you know, right here. Like, she's really the equivalent of peacemaker.
She's looking for common ground.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. And she's trying to get Sam to appeal to everybody's sort of better reason as opposed to this idea of just trying to fight for the sake of winning. And she gets nowhere. And at the end, Sam recoils and he's like,
"You're a political consultant. Your job isn't to end the fight. It's to win it. Now, you can work for us or you can work for them, but you can't do both."
That's a very good point.
Yeah, so I suspect that people are going to say, oh, Mandy, she's, you know, once again, she's getting in the way of our team. But actually, I think she's once again really trying to do the right thing.
As I watched, I found her annoying. But you're bringing me to your side on this. I felt like she seems to be focused on this self-serving. I'm trying to book another client.
Yes.
And over here, and the rest of them are trying to deal with possible nuclear conflagration developing in the rest of the world.
Which is totally understandable.
Yeah. But on the merits of her argument, I see what you're saying.
Yeah. And I wonder if that was intentional. I think it must have been, right, that these two plot lines are happening at the same time.
I think so. I mean, you articulated it very well. I couldn't unpack it the way you just did, but I wrote macro and micro world affairs reflected in personal relationships.
Absolutely, yeah. There's one part, too, that felt like a parallel. Like, I really noted the way the Indian ambassador kind of saunters into the Oval Office. Like, again, there's this potential nuclear crisis happening, and he gets invited in, and he kind of has this jaunty walk. Yeah. He's chipper as he comes in to shake the president's hand.
Mr. President.
Mr. Ambassador.
You look well, Mr. President.
I was looking a lot better before your country breached about 14 ceasefire conditions without so much as a phone call. So let's sit down and talk. Charlie, please close the door.
And as he talks to him about how India will not be dictated to, and it reminded me of Josh in the deposition, both of them are just like, they're sort of cocky in a way that doesn't feel appropriate for the situation.
Brad does a good job. That really does drop away from him when he realizes that he doesn't hold all the cards and that the other side, even if it's illegally obtained, has that information on Leo, and the gravity of the situation hits him, and you can see it in his face and his posture. It's a good scene.
Would you guys come for to the set just for the day that you guys were shooting?
Actually, no, we did table reads.
Table reads.
Okay. And so you know what the whole context of the episode was before it was. Would you usually do everything in a day, or would it take a couple days besides for the actual shooting?
It depended on the episode.
For this one, do you remember?
For this one, it was just the one day, because it was just the one scene itself. I was on the set a couple of times. I got to meet Roger. Our scene wasn't with Roger, but I was back on the set because I was doing some voice work on the lot. For us, it was either, you know, one day, 2 days, a week, depending on the episode itself. But this one was one day.
So was Roger Rees at the table read?
I don't remember. I don't recall that. I'm going to say no.
I think we would have remembered.
Yeah, I think so too.
He's a very important figure to me. I didn't know him personally, but and he passed away last year, I believe. But meant a lot to me. I got lucky in 1982. My mom and dad had tickets to go see Nicholas Nickleby on Broadway. And then my dad had to go out of town for work. And my mom asked me if I wanted to go. 8.5 hours. And we went in one day. You could see it on 2 days. Yeah. We went one day with a dinner break, this epic theatrical
Charles Dickens
version of Nicholas Nickleby. And I was already a theater kid, and I loved going to the theater, and I loved acting. But it was an unbelievable, it was 8.5 hours. Every second was riveting. When it ended, I just wanted it to go on. His performance was fantastic. He obviously played Nicholas Nickleby. And so he's always been this sort of kind of towering figure to me that helped show me what theater could be and how it could make you feel. And I wish I'd gotten the chance to interact with him, but he's pretty great in this episode.
He really is.
Agreed.
I mean, he's probably one of the bigger Sorkin characters, in a sense. Like, you know, just the bigness in which he acts.
Right.
Almost theatrical, but still enough for TV.
I do think it's a character that could have been played badly very easily.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. And physically, too, when he first walks into the Oval Office, he leads with his hand in this way that's comical and amazing.
That's exactly what I thought when I watched it. I was like, there's something brilliant about the way he's shaking the president's hand. Yeah. I'm getting the character in his just physicality.
He had backstory. Oh, no.
We do get his backstory in this. Another thing I noted was that there's like pretty extreme exposition that happens when CJ is just on the phone with somebody. We don't know who she is. And she's just like, here's some exposition, guys. Here's who this character is.
His name is Lord John Marbury. He is the hereditary Earl of Sherlborne. He is the great-great-grandson of a former viceroy, and for 13 years served as the Queen's minister to either India or Pakistan. Lord Marbury is here to counsel the president, and if you think this is all starting to sound like a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta, I don't blame you a bit.
There's a lot of exposition in West Wing often that has to be shared. And Aaron, I would say, generally does a very good job of getting it in a way that's dramatic. I remember in college, we was writing like a sketch show, and there was a whole lot of exposition that had to set up a sketch that we were doing. And so we just had the mother yell to the kid, honey, have you sung the exposition song? She would just come in and sing everything that you needed to know. So I give Aaron credit for never resorting to that.
Yeah, no, this is the closest to the exposition song that we've probably gotten to.
Yeah. Borderline.
You get a Gilbert and Sullivan reference at the end.
That's right.
I wrote that down too. Is it the first of what will be, I think, several Gilbert and Sullivan references?
There's a lot of musical theater stuff in Aaron's.
Aaron majored in musical theater at Syracuse.
I'll tell the story really quick because I noticed that, and I was fortunate enough to interview Aaron for a couple hours from a benefit of my theater company, Ensemble Studio Theater, LA Project. I said, we sit at our table reads, and I know you're a musical theater major from Syracuse, and I listened to your, because Dulé actually brought this up a little bit when you interviewed Dulé. You write musically because you will actually sit in the table read, and as we are reading, you will actually look like a conductor. Your hands will be moving like a conductor a little bit. And he goes, yeah, you're right. And so he writes everything in music. And so I think that's why you see so many references to musical theater. I mean, it is a symphony. He writes a symphony when you watch these Westerns, especially the Walk and Talks.
And the guy is definitely going to write the book for a musical one of these days.
He was supposed to.
He's like Evel Knievel. He keeps driving to the top of the ramp and then going, I'm not quite ready. Because he was supposed to write, I think.
The Flaming Lips.
The Flaming Lips, right? Yeah. Exactly.
Wait, what was that?
Yoshimi and the robots? What's it?
Yeah, Yoshimi battles Flaming Lips. Robots, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was going to collaborate with them on a Broadway or a stage musical of that, or that I would like to have seen. I think Houdini was another musical that he was going to write the book for. And for whatever reason, I can't speak for him, it doesn't quite happen, but the guy is. Got a kick-ass musical in him, for sure. Maybe it'll be the West Wing musical.
I wanted to take back one thing I said about the CJ scene about exposition. It's not like it's completely useless. It sets up some amazing acting from Allison Janney when she then has to turn and address Toby when he comes in the room. She puts down the phone. You know, look, Carol comes in.
CJ?
Thank you.
Yes.
Toby's here.
Okay.
And then she puts down the phone and, like, completely changes her demeanor as she turns around. She, like, kind of does a little physical shift. It's fantastic.
It is a great scene.
Yeah.
Melissa Fitz has a funny line, too. Something about the H.
They put the H in the wrong place?
Hey, I'm happy when they use an H at all.
We'll fix it.
Hey, Carol.
We're fixing the H.
Hey.
This is another episode with a lot of, like the last episode, a lot of okay. Again, more than 20 uses of the word okay.
Okay.
Leo says it. 4 times in one exchange with the president when he's asking him if he has a racial problem with the idea of Charlie dating Zoe. He gives him 4 okays in response after he confronts him.
You got a racial problem?
A racial problem?
It's okay to admit it.
I don't.
Okay.
I don't have a racial problem.
Okay.
I'm Spencer Tracy at the end of Guess Who's Coming to Dinner.
Okay.
Racial problem.
I'm just saying.
My problem is not that she's white, he's black, and she's a girl, and he's not. To say nothing of he's older than she is.
She's 19, he's 21.
Yeah, but a guy learns a lot in those 2 years.
Okay.
Well, let's talk about that little mini subplot. I liked that it was made explicit, that Leo actually brings up, is it a black-white thing? And that then Bartlett realizes if that's in the air... President Bartlett.
Thank you.
Getting a look from across the room. And then President... it's going to be that now for 3 years. But in true President Bartlett fashion, he bridles a little bit. Now, of course, it's not that. But having raised it, President Bartlett wants to make sure that that's not how Charlie took it. And he sits him down and says...
My hesitation about your going out with Zoe before, you know, it's not because you're black.
I didn't think it was.
It's not.
I thought it was because I'm a guy.
It is.
I understand.
Still, I want you to go out with her if that's what you both want to do.
I'd like to.
That's fine.
Thank you, sir.
Just remember these 2 things. She's 19 years old, and the 82nd Airborne works for me.
Yes, sir.
I liked how that was all dealt with.
There's a great example here of art imitating life and then life imitating art again, which is that the guy who's running the subpoena, Claypool, is inspired by a real guy named Larry Klayman, who was this guy who sued all kinds of people, including the Clinton administration a lot. And he had an organization called Justice Watch. And so here, that guy's name is Larry Klayman. This is Harry Claypool. Mm-hmm. And his organization is called Freedom Watch. Well, after this aired, a few years later, Larry Klayman went and copyrighted the name Freedom Watch and now is the head of an organization called Freedom Watch.
Get out of here. I think really to come full circle, he needs to sue Aaron.
That's it.
Right. Or subpoena him at least.
Yes, at the very least.
Things like that would always happen. Our storylines, I mean, I'm sure even when you joined and Peter will back me on this, we'd be sitting at a table read and they had written this obviously weeks before. But what we're talking about in the table read might actually be now happening in the real world. Or what's happened at the table read we are now shooting, and by the time we're shooting it, it's actually now happening in the real world. Or we would shoot it, and it would air, and that's now actually happening in the real world.
And I believe that actually happened with this episode, too, that there was an India-Pakistan conflict that came 2 weeks after this episode came out.
Good advisors.
And now we're going to take a quick break.
And now back to the show. My single favorite moment of this episode was when President Bartlett turns to Leo and says,
he wants to go out with Zoe. Shut up.
My favorite, too.
This sounds like a Three Stooges moment. Yeah. It's only he's like Moe there. Shut up!
Oh, I laughed really hard at that.
Because later, Leo says, I've known him for 40 years. You know, you see that camaraderie, even though there's a president.
There's a lot of good stuff going on in the show in general, and in this episode in particular. Mm. Moments where you learn about people's relationships, even though there isn't a spotlight, and it's maybe not even in the dialogue. For instance, there's a moment where I believe CJ, Toby, and Josh pull Leo into a room to say, hey, this is bad, and the thing about the pills is about to go. And Margaret steps in behind him, and she's part of it. And at first I thought, Margaret's going to be part of this meeting? And it's just a very subtle way of telling us a little bit about the relationship between Margaret and Leo.
Yeah,
she's welcome there. And yeah, she knows about it already. And you can see in her face, this isn't a revelation to her. She knows about it.
There's even a part where they ask Leo, does your family know? And he says yes. And as he says yes, you can see in the background, Margaret is nodding. She knows that they know.
And I'm going to say, I don't think that is necessarily scripted. I think Nicole brought that to the scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the acting is so good on this show. Person to person to person, the guest cast, the recurring cast, the regular cast, the acting is very high level. We talked earlier with Richard about the luxury of being able to rehearse quite a bit before putting this stuff on film. And that's probably something that happened. You know, Margaret's there during rehearsal. They probably discussed, is she going to go into the room? Is she not? And I'm sure it did come from the actors and their desire to create this relationship between two characters that they decided, yeah, she would be in there.
And then from what I've heard about how TV works in general, then when the writer sees that, they're like, oh, and then it informs what they write later on.
Aaron specifically is such a sponge and really, really watches the end result, and then I think he takes what the actors are giving him and runs with it.
Yeah, Melissa Fitzgerald told us she read for two parts, but they were already cast, so she knew she wasn't going to be up for either of those, and she ended up getting, you know, she had one line, I think, in the pilot, but she was saying that there's this importance that was placed on that every single actor on the show had the ability to knock it out of the park, even if they only have one line, and so they wanted to see that range and that depth. That's why they had to read, you know, these other parts.
Huh. So kudos to Nicole Robinson for that very subtle, beautiful, silent piece of acting.
Mm-hmm. So there's one thing I also wanted to ask you guys about, which is that Toby, CJ thing. Toby comes to her and he says,
I feel that I didn't have the opportunity to properly articulate my argument.
Either I'm a trusted member of the communication staff or I'm not, Toby. What was your argument?
That was my argument.
That wasn't your argument.
It was my argument a little while ago when I was arguing in my head.
Are you apologizing?
Yes.
Well?
What?
Apologize.
I'm sorry.
God.
I was trying to do it nicer than that.
Whose idea was it?
Mine.
You were the one who said India has invaded Pakistan, let's not tell CJ?
I didn't say it like that.
Why'd you say it?
Said it nicer.
I didn't quite know what to make of that because as far as I could tell, and I went and watched the scene again, it wasn't Toby's idea. It seemed like Leo kind of made the call on the fly, and the president gives him this nod of like, of agreement, yes, we're going to leave CJ out of this. And Toby actually seems conflicted about it. You know, Leo says, I'll brief her in the morning. And Toby says, yeah. He's like, I'm going along with it. But then when she comes back to him and she says, whose idea was it? He says, it's mine. And I wasn't sure if that was an example of him sort of not passing the buck.
I think maybe that is what it was.
I think so.
Rather than having her be mad at everyone, let it be me and let's work this out.
Yes, because he's the one who was actually least okay with her being left out. And it wasn't made explicit, and I like that it wasn't made explicit. That felt like it said a lot about their relationship and him as sort of like the head of the department. I don't know, I like that.
And that moment in the Oval when they tell her it's a full lid, it felt boys clubby.
Absolutely.
Good evening.
Hello.
I'm sorry. Charlie and Mrs. Lanningham stepped away. Should I go back and wait in the...
No. We were just breaking up.
Can I tell the room there's a full lid?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll send him home.
Thanks, CJ.
Thank you, Mr. President.
I'll brief her in the morning.
Yeah.
It's like the boys are going to stay here and discuss what's really going on, and we're just not going to really tell you about it. Okay, but talk to you later.
Yeah. Yeah. People might perceive misogyny in the show as something like they want to somehow attribute it to Aaron as opposed to like the fabric of the plot. But here, I think that is absolutely part of the plot, you know, that you have all these guys in a room and she's the girl who comes in and they shut her out.
I can only imagine it's a fabric of the real DC, too.
Right. As you said, it was inspired by a real thing that happened to Dee Dee Myers. So.
Right.
Yeah. There is one thing, though, that I will criticize a little bit or cringed a little bit, which is when they're talking about the lasciviousness of Lord John Marbury.
He's colorful, Leo.
You're really going to let him loose in the White House where there's liquor and women?
We can hide the women, but the man deserves a drink.
Sir.
And that ties in, and then there's four mentions of a dungeon that President Bartlett wishes he had.
This idea
it's
that...
It's a little rough, hide the women.
Yeah, exactly. Like he has these two vices, and they're both about consuming things, that there's this tacit acceptance that the idea that women are meant to be consumed, and this guy is smart enough or whatever, capable enough that he gets a pass.
Something else about the Lord John Marbury thing that I thought of is how it would play today that three white men are talking about something happening in Pakistan and India.
Yes.
So that was interesting to me.
Right. Yeah. Let's bring in our expert, this British guy.
Yeah.
This British fop who
yeah. I was thinking about that,
time.
But I felt like they set that up well enough with the idea that they don't yet have an ambassador. They don't have a guy over there for Pakistan, and because I was like, man, they couldn't get somebody who actually knows something. They have to bring, they have to import a foreigner, but the foreigner happens to also be another white guy.
Roger Rees is actually Welsh. Is that correct?
I'll look it up in the Encyclopedia.
I believe
Britannica.
He is. Let's throw that in there. Even before he comes on screen, we're ready for this guy who's just a character and he's big and he's dissolute. And then he comes and Roger Rees absolutely delivers on it. It's even better than you thought it was coming. And then, of course, he does this classic thing where you also find that he's got also a seriousness of mind and a mastery of the information. And there's more to him.
Happily ensconced in the cocoon of your Cold War victory, you are woefully ignorant of the powerful historical agents in Asia. The global triumph of the economic free market has created an illusory assumption that the world is drawing itself closer together. Your Congress has been pathetically inept at halting the proliferation of nuclear weapons in this region, and your intelligence gathering is weak. India and Pakistan have fought three wars in the half century since they have gained their independence, with God knows how many skirmishes in between. It is about religion.
And you can get why President Bartlett might want him to stick around for a little while. And it's a great little turn at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's really the first person that I think we've seen to kind of like discomfit Leo. Like the, it's the first time he's been thrown off his game, even in the face of like this incredible controversy that's about to bear down on him. He's, you know,
he's
armored
miffed.
Up for that.
Yeah, he thinks I'm the butler.
And that's, I think that's also part of the reason why I think the president likes him too.
Yeah, I think so too. Actually, it takes the piss out of Leo. But that's classic Sorkinism is... not being able to remember people's names.
Hence our two characters.
Well, I think also, that's interesting. Let's get back to you guys. I don't think Aaron necessarily wanted people to know which one of you is Ed and which
no.
one of you is Larry,
well,
right?
I remember it kind of being inspired by people actually on West Wing bulletin boards not knowing which was Ed and Larry.
Right.
And he kind of ran with it from then.
Yeah, he had fun with it.
Yeah.
Seriously, I think Aaron got screwed up a few times. Because he even said to me, oh, we got to switch lines. I'm sorry. Because he did say to me one time, I thought you were Ed. Yeah. So it was just fun that way. I mean.
I was joking around saying it was just it turned my whole world upside down to see you alone without Duffy, to see Ed without Larry. But so he just needed one of you that day. It wasn't.
That was for the shortlist. You were talking about.
Shortlist, right. Yeah. It's not that you were doing something else that day.
I actually was doing something else that day.
So that's what I wanted to know. What were you doing?
I was doing some voice work that day. And to be honest, it wasn't until Lord John Marbury that I said, okay, I think we're actually going to be on this show. Because the pilot was great. The next couple episodes, we just had very little stuff to do. And I'm like, I don't know if this is actually going to happen or not. And I wasn't too sure where the show was going to go because nothing had really aired really yet. And I thought the show would go a little bit, but I said, you know, I have a voice job. So I did that. And I don't know if I would have been in the episode or not.
I did get that call last minute. I do remember that.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you guys about the day of shooting again. Mm-hmm. So you've already done the table read. I just want to know what the mechanics are for when you guys do your scene. It's so quick and snappy and your guys' chemistry and rhythm is so good. And I'm just wondering, like, is that something that that you guys, you know, it's not like you've done 11 episodes at this point to have the practice of that, but it feels of a piece with everything else that's happening on screen.
You know, after you come out of hair and makeup, there's a rehearsal. That's when we kind of maybe meet the director for the first time, who's directing that episode. There might be ones that we know because they've directed others, but we meet, and we've already said hello to the cast regulars who we know, but that's when we meet really the director for the first time. And so he gives us an idea of what we want blocking wise, and then we just go off getting our final touches, then come back and we shoot it.
And no, Aaron. Aaron's not around. He's in a room somewhere desperately
Aaron
trying
very
to churn
rarely,
out the next episode.
Yeah, exactly. Aaron is rarely around. I mean, he's up in the booth listening, because there'll be times when somebody has a question about a line. I don't know if you've talked about this before with your listeners, but you do Aaron's words the way Aaron's words are written. And there's no and that I'm sure you even know, we had some problems with some people who come on the show and not know that that's what they have to do. They just ad-lib or whatever, and there's no ad-libbing when you do Sorkin. So every once in a while, when there was a question about some writing by anybody, he might come down and give us 2 cents, mm-hmm. or just tell you what you're going to do. he's brilliant what he does. So
when you guys are on a show like this and you're recurring characters, but you're not in every episode, is it hard to, I guess, schedule the rest of your life around that? You're kind of on call. You said you got the call last minute sometimes. Was that hard to just sort of, I guess, be a working actor when you know you're going to be needed sometimes? But
it's kind of the deal for working actors in LA.
For me, it's like, you know, it wasn't until this episode that I started thinking, okay, I may actually start coming back a little bit. We sat there in that Roosevelt room with those, you know, three main characters. It seemed like we were going to work with others at that time. There was a quote that you read from Aaron from that book, but Aaron had said Ed and Larry had represents about maybe 20 to 30 people in the real West Wing.
Right.
You can't have that many characters. So that gave me another clue that we were probably going to recur a little bit more.
But did it mess things up for you, being like on call?
Oh, yeah. For me, it did.
As one learns, as they've lived in this town long enough, this industry, you just have to live your life.
Yeah.
In Bartlett's third State of the Union, I got a job that conflicted. And everyone leaves the Oval Office to go to the cars outside, and I start with the group, and by the time we're at the end of the group, I'm not in the group anymore because I was off shooting something else, because that was a different day.
That's funny.
A little continuity error to look forward to. Yeah.
But it happens
all
the time.
What happened?
We've lost Ed.
The motorcade's left him behind.
But no, it happens a lot. I mean, you know, your personal life, I mean, even I was married at that time, but it screwed up a lot, like anniversaries and stuff like that. We'd run over in shooting. It was crazy. But that's the way it does. It happens.
I didn't think about that. I don't think we talked about that. That the Leo's sort of divorce story in this
reflected.
That could be a parallel from actually working on a TV show.
Mm-hmm.
No, yeah, they own you. They really do.
They do.
Own you. It's very hard to get to the dentist. I've canceled a lot of dental appointments. Yeah.
The key thing is to plan things, because that means you'll work.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, you book a plane ticket anywhere, and you'll end up having to shoot that day. So that's the new rule I go by.
There's one thing about the episode that we haven't talked about yet that I wanted to bring up. I wanted to point out about the dating of this episode compared to where we are now, mm-hmm. where Lord John Marbury says,
"Not since the Protestant Catholic Wars in the 16th century has Western society known anything remotely comparable to the subcontinent's religious malevolence."
And I feel like that's such old news now. For us, even being on the other side of the world from it, the idea of like internal religious conflict is part of our everyday news cycle.
Mm. Right. We don't have to go back a few hundred years. Right,
yeah, exactly.
To find a parallel.
Even though the Sunni-Shiite conflict is already at this point at the making of the episode, you know, whatever, 1,300 years old, it wasn't a part of the language of American society the way it is now.
Good point. How about the very, very, very last moment? I love the attention to detail. I love that President Bartlett tosses the lighter to Lord John, and it's even under the
and
closing
credits
we hear the cigarette thing.
Yeah.
I shall require a light.
For some reason, I loved that. I can't even really articulate why.
Yeah.
But I loved hearing that little audio continuation of the scene under the credits.
That happens a few times, that little post-lap of, you know, sound overlapping with the fade to black. It's really great.
We need a word for that. The flental. I'm just tossing that out. That's called the flental.
The
well, my, I have a nephew black. Who, you know how when a show, like a sitcom, comes back after the final credits and there's a last little funny moment?
Right.
He calls that the wuzzing.
Uh-huh.
So I'm going to say a little audio moment under the beginning of the final credits will be the flental.
The flental. All
right. And I can tell you're going to like that as much as when I toss out a cheese to accompany.
Yes. Yeah.
Big block of cheese day. look for other flentils, people, and write it.
No, you wouldn't look for a flental.
No, I guess you listen for one. That's a very good point.
Yeah.
But then, you know, with our watching on Netflix or there aren't broadcast commercials anymore, then you get immediately jarred into the cheery, chipper end music again. And sometimes, you don't get to bask in that moment as much as you'd like.
This goes back to the flental. We ask people to take, also not to do the auto start of the next episode.
I turned mine off because
you did.
Guys.
Good really? Man.
Yes. But then you get... No matter how heavy the episode
right.
was.
It is jarring.
I love that, though. I mean, I hadn't heard that in so long, that opening credit music. And when I heard it, I was like, oh, my God. It brought back so many memories.
It is awfully good.
Just the swell of the music just brought me.
Well, no, the intro music... I have no complaints about it's the outro music.
Yeah. Oh, the outro. Oh, okay.
Ruins a perfectly good flental. Do people still name check you from West Wing?
Yeah, I was actually over at the Grove last week going down the escalator and somebody's coming up the escalator the other way and goes, West Wing! I'm like, yeah.
And do you just go down and up and down and up until someone recognizes
you? That's it.
Do you guys ever get booked together for stuff post West Wing?
For this podcast.
For this podcast.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you guys... We got to put together some sort of West Wing convention. I think there's some ancillary money that we're not.
I think it needs to be called SoarCon.
Yeah. SoarCon.
SoarCon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Nice. That's
branded.
So much better than my idea to do ScottCon.
Scott.
Just Con? Convention built around Scott Con and his career.
I see.
Oh.
Well, okay. Or James Con. Maybe older people would come to it. What are you guys up to now? Anything you want to promote or talk about?
Oh, gosh. I guess the two things I have in the can that haven't aired yet is an episode of Secrets and Lies on ABC and Westworld, where I got to work with Anthony Hopkins, which was awesome. Yeah.
Is he Sir Anthony? He must be, right?
I think
he's
so,
Tony,
yes.
He's Tony, right?
Oh, actually, he does. He did introduce himself as Tony. That's true.
Nice. Yeah. Did you crush his hand?
I didn't.
Okay.
Yeah.
I only do that.
Did you work with him?
Yeah.
Oh, dude.
Yeah. It was
awesome.
Nice.
That's great.
Bucket list. And Secrets and Lies, what are you doing that? When's that?
Oh, I'm like a banker guy, and I don't know if they have an air date yet.
Fair enough. And did you just complete a play?
Or? I understudied a play.
How was that? I always found it very nerve-wracking to understudy. How was the experience for you?
Well, you know, first of all, we like paychecks.
Yes.
And, you know, a week at that level of theater pays as much as a whole run at a 99-seat theater. Mm-hmm. So that was an easy decision. It was a good time. I mean, I got to hang out backstage with the other understudies, you know, 24 hours a week.
You did not go on?
I did not go on. I learned cribbage backstage. So
nice.
Everyone plays cribbage. I'm looking for partners.
I got my sister's way into it, but I've never learned.
Okay.
I'm a poker guy. But
you got paid to learn cribbage.
Exactly.
Look at that.
Yeah.
Huh?
And what about you, Duffy? What do you have to?
Actually, I just had an episode of the finale at NCIS just aired. I was in that.
Nice.
That's really a nice set as
Did
well.
Did you get to work with Michael Weatherly before?
I didn't. I was with Mark Harmon and the other gang.
When you saw Michael Weatherly, did you yell, quitter?
Quitter. That was a lot of fun. That's a great set. And but I have, actually, speaking of one acts, I actually have a one act play that we're doing at a festival, and I'm going to do one of those. I haven't done a play in a while, so with Ensemble Studio Theater out here in LA, and that'll be all of July.
Awesome. What's that called?
It's called The Mediator, but it's about a 15-20 minute piece. It's part of a one act festival that we're doing over the entire month of July.
Fantastic. Break a leg. We'll
Thank
have to come
you.
See
Thank you. Yeah, definitely coming. It's a nice little fun comedy. I solve cases between people with their dog problems.
Oh, you are the mediator.
I am the mediator.
Nice.
Mm.
William Duffy is the mediator.
This
Get
summer
paid
on ESPN.
To learn cribbage.
This summer on NBC.
Ask me how.
Ask me how. What are you doing?
I got nothing. Scandal's done for now. I have this podcast for the next 3 years and change.
Nice.
Rishi asked me the other day, he said, did you feel misled about how much work it would take to do this? I said, misled. I was scammed because because you said it would essentially be no work whatsoever, and it's taking over my entire life.
You gotta love it, though.
I am actually. I am enjoying the process of doing it. I don't see my friends or old friends really ever. Like seeing you two guys, it's been years and years and years. Yeah. It's a delight to see you guys.
We did like the PSA walk and talks. So I saw you on that.
That's true. Occasionally, somebody comes up with some sort of mini West Wing reunion.
And you're going to see ATX people.
And I am going to see a few at ATX, which I'm really looking forward to.
And hopefully we'll see you guys a lot, too, as we move through the seasons.
You guys will come back, right?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you guys so much for talking to us.
This was a lot of fun.
It was definitely a pleasure.
And thanks to all of you for listening. We hope you'll join us next time. In the meantime, if you have comments or questions, you can discuss this episode with us on our Facebook page, facebook.com/thewestwingweekly, or on our website, thewestwingweekly.com. Or you can hit us up on Twitter. You can hit up any of us. I'm at Rishi Hirway. Josh is at Josh Molina. Peter is at
PJS Actor.
And William Duffy is at William Duffy underscore.
Underscore, yeah, because I couldn't get the William Duffy.
Okay.
Okay.
What's next?
This is the Flental.
If you're looking for another podcast to listen to, check out Normal Gossip from Radiotopia. They're coming back for their sixth season. If you don't already know the show, they were named one of the best podcasts of the year by Time Magazine and Vulture, and their new season starts April 17th. Normal Gossip is really fun. It's a show about petty and ridiculous and strange stories and the way that we share those stories. The stories that they tell in the podcast are sent in by listeners, and then they're anonymized and then retold to a guest, and then they have to weigh in on the decisions that the people in the story are making. It's very funny and very beloved. So if you aren't already listening, check out the new season, which starts April 17th. You can listen to Normal Gossip wherever you get your podcasts.
Radiotopia from PR.